Katra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome, curious minds, to another deep dive. You know, if we think about diseases that just fill us with this immediate sense of dread.
Cancer has to be top of the list for most people.
Absolutely. It feels so huge, unpredictable, kind of shrouded in complexity, right?
Yeah, and that fear is totally understandable for generations. People saw cancer as this, like, unstoppable external force, just bad luck.
A malevolent invader, almost.
Right. But today, our mission, drawing on the work of Professor Nicholas James, is really to shift that perception.
We want to try and peel back some of those layers of fear.
Yeah.
To demystify the disease a bit. Treat it less like a curse and more like, well, a really complex biological puzzle.
A puzzle rooted in our own cells.
Exactly.
That shift in thinking, I mean, that's where the modern hope really comes from. Cancer isn't some alien thing. It's a distortion, a perversion of the very systems that keep us alive.
It's like a design flaw that turns deadly.
Yeah, a consequence of our own cellular machinery malfunctioning. Cells forgetting they're supposed to have limits. It's not about external evil. It's about internal control breaking down.
Okay, let's get into this journey then. Our main source here is the work of Professor Nicholas James. And what's really interesting about him is his background, isn't it?
It really is. He's got this dual perspective. He's a professor of clinical oncology, so he's deep in the research.
The cutting edge science.
Mm-hmm. But he's also a consultant clinical oncologist.
Yeah.
He actually treats patients day in, day out.
So he sees both sides. The lab bench and the bedside.
Precisely. And that's, well, it's invaluable. It lets him connect that really abstract genetic science, you know, sequencing mutations, protein pathways, with the human reality of getting a diagnosis and going through treatment. He sees the science making a difference.
Right. So if we strip away the fear, like we said, what's the core idea Professor James wants us to get?
I think the biggest thing is just ditching the idea of the cancer. Like, it's one simple thing. His central point is crystal clear. Cancer isn't monolithic. It's really just a catch-all term.
For what?
For, like, over 200 distinct diseases. Maybe more now. Each one with its own specific genetic signature, its own way of behaving.
Wow, 200. That diversity is crucial, then, because if you're fighting 200 different enemies...
You can't use just one weapon, can you? You need targeted strategies.
Okay, but let's back up even further. Before we get to the errors... What about the normal process? How are our cells supposed to work?
Right. So normally, everything runs on this very tightly controlled schedule of the cell cycle. It's this constant dance of cells growing, dividing when needed, repairing damage.
But there's a key safety mechanism too, right? Something about programmed death.
Yes. Absolutely crucial. Apoptosis. Programmed cell death.
So basically, the body's self-destruct button for cells, like quality control.
That's a great way to put it. Quality control. When a cell gets too old or it's damaged or it just starts acting weirdly, it's supposed to gracefully eliminate itself.
To maintain the overall health of the tissue.
Exactly. It keeps everything in balance. Cancer is essentially that catastrophic moment when a cell just refuses to die. It ignores all the stop signals.
It breaks the rules.
Completely ignores the control system.
Professor James uses this really helpful analogy. The accelerator and the brakes... to explain how that control fails. Let's start with the accelerator, the go signals.
Okay, so those are the oncogenes. These are actually normal genes involved in growth, but when they get mutated, they can get stuck in the on position.
Like a jammed gas pedal.
Precisely. Just constantly shouting, grow, divide, faster, relentless signals.
And the brakes. The system's meant to stop that runaway growth.
Those are the tumor suppressor genes. You might have heard of some, like P53 or maybe BRCA1 and BRCA2, linked to breast cancer risk.
Right.
When these genes get mutated or damaged, they stop working. The brakes fail.
So the cell loses its ability to hit the brakes or even trigger that self-destruct, the apoptosis we mentioned.
Exactly. And that combination, jammed accelerator, failed brakes, it leads to this, well, terrifying outcome. A cell achieving a kind of immortality within a body that's fundamentally mortal is a rebellion from within.
Okay, understanding how it happens is one thing, but the question everyone asks is, why? Why me? Why did my cells rebel?
And the answer is usually complicated. James calls it a sort of conspiracy, a combination of factors.
What kind of factors?
Well, there's chance, there's environment and lifestyle, and then there's the genetics you inherit.
Let's start with chance. That sounds a bit... unfair.
It can feel that way, but think about it. Every single time one of your cells divides, it has to copy billions of letters of DNA code perfectly.
Billions. Mistakes are bound to happen sometimes, just statistically.
Exactly. Errors slip through. Most are harmless or get repaired, but sometimes, purely by chance, a mistake hits a critical gene, like one of those oncogenes or tumor suppressor genes.
And that directly explains why age is the single biggest risk factor for most cancers, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The longer you live, the more your cells have divided.
More spins of the genetic lottery wheel.
You got it. More opportunities for those chance errors to accumulate. And that's key. It's usually not just one mistake, one hit. It typically takes a cascade of several mutations, often over many years, many decades, to fully turn a normal cell cancerous.
So age and chance are sort of passive risks. What about the active risks? The things we do that damage DNA.
Right. Those are the environmental and lifestyle factors, the carcinogens. The obvious one is tobacco smoke.
Still the biggest preventable cause.
By far. But also things like excessive alcohol, too much UV radiation from the sun, or tanning beds. These things directly damage the DNA structure. They increase the odds of one of those critical mutations happening.
And certain infections play a role, too.
Yes, definitely. Chronic infections like HPV, human papillomavirus, or hepatitis B and C can also contribute to cancer development by disrupting normal cell processes or causing chronic inflammation, which itself can drive mutations.
Okay, so chance, lifestyle. What about the inherited part?
That accounts for a small percentage of cancers overall, maybe 5-10%, but it's significant for those families affected.
Like the BRCA genes again.
Exactly. If you inherit a faulty copy of a crucial tumor suppressor gene, like BRCA1, it means you start life with one of your main breaks already faulty in every cell.
So you're already one step down that cascade of mutations needed for cancer.
Precisely. You don't need as many subsequent chance or environmental hits to accumulate before a tumor might form. The threshold is lower. It's still usually a multi-step process, but you have a head start, unfortunately.
Okay. So the cell is broken free, achieved this dangerous immortality. But what makes cancer so deadly isn't usually the primary tumor itself, right? It's the spread.
That's right. We have to talk about metastasis. That's the process that makes cancer a systemic disease, and often what makes it fatal.
How does that actually work? How does it spread?
It's a multi-step journey for the cancer cell. First, it has to break away from the main tumor and invade the surrounding tissue.
Then it needs to get into transport.
Exactly. It has to somehow get into a blood vessel or a lymph vessel that's called intravasation. Then it has to survive tumbling through the bloodstream or lymph system, which is actually quite a hostile environment. It often has to evade the immune system cells patrolling there.
Like a fugitive on the run.
Kinda, yeah. If it survives that journey, it has to lodge somewhere else in the body in a distant organ, like the lungs, liver, brain, or bones.
And then get out of the transport system again.
Right. It has to exit the blood vessel extravasation and then start growing in that new location, forming a secondary tumor or metastasis.
And that's why it's so dangerous. Because it's not just one location anymore.
Precisely. By the time metastatic cancer is often diagnosed, there might be millions of tiny microscopic deposits spread throughout the body. You can't just cut them all out.
The enemy is everywhere.
Which means you need a treatment that can go everywhere too, systemic treatment.
Okay. So before doctors can even think about treatment, they need to know exactly what they're dealing with. How do they map out the enemy?
Well, it often starts with screening. These are tests done on people without symptoms, aiming for early detection. Things like mammograms, colonoscopies, pap smears.
Finding it early makes a huge difference.
Massive difference. But if screening or symptoms suggest something might be wrong, the next crucial step is a diagnosis, which almost always requires a biopsy.
Taking a small sample of the suspicious tissue.
Exactly. A pathologist looks at those cells under a microscope to confirm if it is cancer, and importantly, what type of cancer it is. Remember those 200 plus types? The biopsy helps pinpoint which one.
So you know what it is, then you need to know where it is and how far it's spread. That's staging, right?
Correct. Staging is absolutely critical because it tells the doctors the extent of the cancer, which dictates the treatment plan and gives an idea of the prognosis.
And how is staging done? Is there a standard system?
Yes. The most common system used worldwide is the TNM system. It's pretty logical.
TNM. What do they stand for?
T stands for the size and extent of the primary tumor. N stands for nodes, whether the cancer has spread to nearby lymph nodes. and M stands for metastasis, whether the cancer has spread to distant parts of the body.
Okay, tumor nodes, metastasis.
Right. And each letter gets a number, like T1, N0, M0 might be a small tumor that hasn't spread to nodes or distantly, whereas T4, N2, M1 would be a large advanced cancer that has spread quite a bit.
And knowing that exact stage, say, stage 2 versus stage 4, completely changes the approach.
Completely. Stage I or 2 might be treatable with just local therapy like surgery or radiation. Mm-hmm. But once you have positive nodes, N1, N2, or especially metastasis, M1, you almost always need systemic treatment as well. The staging tells you the goal. Is it cure or is it control?
That makes sense. It provides the map. Okay, so this brings us nicely to treatment. And treatment has evolved massively, hasn't it? From what James calls the sledgehammer approach.
To more of a scalpel today.
Let's talk about the old pillars first. For decades, there were basically three main ways to treat cancer. They saved millions, but they weren't very specific.
Right. The three historical pillars. First, surgery. Conceptually simple. Cut the tumor out. Very effective for localized cancers.
Pillar two.
Radiotherapy or radiation treatment. Using high-energy X-rays or other particles to target and damage the DNA of cancer cells in a specific area, causing them to die. Again, mostly a local treatment.
And pillar three. The first big systemic weapon.
Chemotherapy. This was a huge revolution because it was the first treatment that could travel through the bloodstream and kill cancer cells almost anywhere in the body.
But you called it a sledgehammer earlier. Why?
Because most traditional chemotherapy drugs work by killing any rapidly dividing cell. Yes, that includes cancer cells, but...
It also includes healthy cells that divide quickly.
Exactly. Like the cells in your hair follicles.
Hence the hair loss.
Your gut lining.
Nausea, digestive issues.
And your bone marrow, which makes blood cells.
Leading to fatigue, infection risk, bleeding.
Right. So chemotherapy, while life-saving for many, came with significant side effects, significant toxicity. It worked, but it was rough. And that really drove the search for something better, something smarter.
And that search led to the new era. Targeted therapy.
Yeah.
The scalpel, as you said. How does this work so precisely?
It's a completely different philosophy.
Yeah.
Instead of just killing all fast-growing cells, targeted therapy aims at specific molecules, usually proteins that are known to be driving the growth of that particular cancer.
So you need to know the cancer's specific vulnerability first.
Exactly. The process usually involves sequencing the tumor's DNA to find the specific mutation, the specific oncogene that's acting like that jammed accelerator we talked about.
Okay.
Then scientists design a drug, often a pill, that specifically blocks the action of that mutated protein. It interferes with that specific go signal.
And the classic example of this changed everything, didn't it?
It really did. Gleevec, the drug imatinib for chronic myeloid leukemia, or CML.
What did it target?
CML is caused by a very specific genetic mistake that creates an abnormal protein called BCR-ABL. This protein is only found in the cancer cells, not in healthy cells.
Ah, so it's a unique target.
A perfect unique target. Gleevec was designed to fit perfectly into that BCR-ABL protein and switch it off. And the results were stunning.
It turned a deadly leukemia
into a manageable chronic condition, often controlled with just taking a pill every day, with far fewer side effects than traditional chemo. It proved the concept beautifully.
So the whole way of thinking shifted. Treat the mutation, not just the location where the cancer happens to be.
Precisely. You could have lung cancer driven by mutation X and breast cancer driven by the same mutation X and potentially use the same targeted drug for both. It's about the molecular fingerprint.
Okay. Targeted therapy was the scalpel, but maybe the biggest recent breakthrough involves harnessing our own bodies. Immunotherapy.
Yes, this is arguably the most exciting frontier in cancer treatment right now. The concept is just incredibly powerful. Instead of using external drugs or radiation to kill cancer,
you get the patient's own immune system to do the job.
Exactly. Leverage the body's natural defense system.
But wait, if our immune system is supposed to recognize and kill abnormal cells, why doesn't it just take care of cancer cells automatically?
Ah, because cancer cells are clever. They evolve ways to hide from the immune system, or crucially, to actively switch it off.
They put the brakes on the immune cells?
That's a perfect analogy. Many cancer cells display proteins on their surface that basically tell incoming immune cells, particularly T cells, nothing to see here, move along, I'm one of you. They hit an off switch, a checkpoint, on the T cell.
So immunotherapy tries to block that off signal.
Exactly. The most successful types of immunotherapy so far are called checkpoint inhibitors, drugs like PD-1 or PD-L1 blockers. They essentially block that off signal between the cancer cell and the T cell.
Releasing the brakes on the T cell.
Releasing the brakes, allowing the T cell to recognize the cancer cell as foreign and attack it. We're not boosting the immune system per se, we're just removing the gag order that the cancer imposed on it.
Unleashing the body's own highly specific, highly powerful weapon.
Precisely. And when it works, the results can be dramatic and long-lasting because the immune system has memory.
That idea, turning the body into its own targeted weapon, feels like it leads directly to the ultimate goal James talks about, personalization.
It really does. The future vision is a world where every single person's cancer gets fully profiled at the molecular level. We find its specific drivers, its specific weaknesses, how it's interacting with the immune system.
And tailor the treatment exactly to that individual profile.
Right. And we're seeing technologies emerge that support this, like liquid biopsies.
What are those?
These are amazing. Basically just a blood test that can detect tiny fragments of DNA shed by cancer cells circulating in the bloodstream.
Wow. So you could potentially detect cancer much earlier or monitor how well a treatment is working just from a blood draw?
That's the promise. Less invasive than repeated tissue biopsies and potentially much earlier detection or relapse monitoring. It all feeds into this vision.
The vision of transforming cancer.
Yes. Transforming it for many, hopefully most, patients from an acute, often fatal diagnosis into a manageable chronic disease, something you live with. Managed effectively long-term, like we manage heart disease or diabetes today.
That's a profoundly hopeful shift. So if someone listening has taken all this, the biology, the causes, the treatments, what are the absolute core messages we want them to take away from this deep dive?
I think there are three key takeaways. First, and maybe most fundamental, diversity. Please reject that old monolithic idea of cancer.
It's not one thing.
It's over 200 things. Understanding the specific subtype, the specific molecular drivers in your specific cancer is where the hope lies. Precision is key.
Okay, diversity. What's number two?
Science is the engine of hope. This whole journey we've discussed from the slash, burn, poison era of surgery, radiation, chemo.
Sledgehammers.
To the molecular precision of targeted therapy and immunotherapy, that progress didn't happen by magic. It happened through relentless scientific research. Understanding the biology unlocks new treatments. Science is the source of optimism here.
Science brings hope. Got it. And number three.
This one's maybe more practical, but just as vital. The power of prevention and early detection. We celebrate these incredible high-tech treatments, but we cannot forget the basics.
The things we can control.
Exactly. Not smoking is huge. Maintaining a healthy weight, regular exercise, protecting your skin from the sun, limiting alcohol. These significantly reduce risk. And crucially, participating in recommended screening programs. Finding cancer early often makes it much, much easier to treat, potentially cure. Prevention and screening are still our most powerful weapons overall.
Diversity, science is hope, and prevention power. Those are great summaries. You know, reflecting on all this, there's a powerful idea that seems to capture the new goal. The goal is no longer just to cure at any cost, but transforming cancer into a manageable chronic disease with which one can live a long and full life. The future of cancer care is as much about quality of life as it is about length of life.
That reframing is just so important, isn't it? It moves away from this binary cure or death mindset, which was often the reality, towards something much more nuanced and, frankly, hopeful for many more people. Long-term management, quality of life.
It feels incredibly liberating. Okay, so based on everything we've discussed, especially the leaps in genomic sequencing, AI spotting patterns, understanding these precancerous mutations, here's a final thought for your listeners to mull over.
Okay.
How close are we, really, to a point where we could identify an individual specific accumulation of those genetic hits, those errors building up over time, and maybe even correct them before they ever get the chance to form a fully malignant tumor?
Proactive genetic repair, almost.
Exactly. Preventing cancer before it even starts at the molecular level. If we could do that, what kind of ethical questions, public health challenges, even societal changes would that kind of ultimate precision prevention bring? Something to think about. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Yekatra Foundation.